Welcome to the Pursuit of Wellbeing podcast. My name's Maria Brosnan. I'm the founder of Pursuit and your host for the show. This podcast is dedicated to providing wellbeing information, inspiration, and support for teachers, leaders, and school staff around the world. My guest today is Sinead McBrady. Sinead is Chief Executive Officer of Education Support. Sinead spent the first half of her career at KPMG's financial services business before moving to the not-for-profit sector as Deputy Chief Executive at Social Enterprise London and subsequently a director at Social Enterprise Women Like Us and TimeWise. Before joining Education Support, she worked as an organisational development consultant with Systemic Coaching Partners and was a visiting lecturer at Imperial College London and the Royal College of Art. So many questions already, Sinead. Sinead advocates for a systemic approach to wellbeing and mental health, highlighting the significance of teacher wellbeing for pupil learning and mental health, as well as social and economic outcomes. She's a governor at a South London primary school. Sinead, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Maria. Thanks a million for having me on.
It's a great pleasure. Well, I guess the first place to start for people who are not familiar with Education Support, could you tell us what the charity does, please?
Of course. Well, we've been around for 144 years and we're set up by teachers for teachers. And in terms of what we do, actually the work we do now is very comparable to what we were doing when we were founded. So we try and help at three different levels of the sector. We support individuals with their emotional and mental health as well as their welfare. So we probably, those who've heard of us probably have heard of us through our helpline. We have a free helpline that's available 24 hours a day and is staffed by accredited counsellors who are there to have a conversation with anyone who would like to have a conversation. And that doesn't mean people who are in crisis. It means anyone who'd like to reflect on something that's happening and affecting them. So that helpline is available to anyone working in any educational setting. But as alongside that, we also make financial grants available to people who are working in education and are in financial distress. And we have a variety of digital resources on our website. So that's all stuff that we do to help individuals, if you like. The second level we work at is the workplace, because if we can improve education workplaces and help schools and colleges to become better workplaces, we think that's going to make a material difference to the people working in them. And so we support those workplaces to provide face-to-face counselling in the old days, telephone and video now, of course. But we also do workplace surveys or resilience training, and we run facilitated peer support networks for leaders, in particular in schools. And the third thing we do, having worked with the individual, the workplace, the third thing that we do is advocate for improvement, really. So we research in some detail the mental health and well-being of the education workforce, and then we use those findings to advocate for improvement in the education system. So talking to government, talking to policymakers about where things need to improve and being able to evidence that with the data that we have unearthed through our research.
And that feels like a really good place to start then, Sinead. What is the current picture that you're seeing through your research?
Well, you won't be surprised, Maria, to know that it's a grim picture, you know, and I can very easily become a miserabilist here because the data just isn't very cheery. Yeah. We've seen, even before COVID, really, we've seen stress, anxiety and depression at relatively high levels, significantly higher than the general population for those working in education. And those had been increasing year on year. In 2020, we were starting to see a plateau, really, of those factors. But then, of course, COVID hit. And so really what we have is a picture of very high levels of pressure on the mental health and well-being of educators, more symptoms evident. And then this very strange and acute, well, what was acute but now is becoming chronic, experience of living through a pandemic. And there's obviously a lot of debate about whether educators shoulder, you know, relatively more pressure as a result of that than others. I think we see evidence that they do, and that they have experienced, you know, more pressure on their mental health in terms of coming from sources like anxiety, You know, personal health and safety has been of great concern over the last 12 months, and very understandably so. But also people are concerned about the children and young people that they work with. And I think, you know, our educators are right up really as the key adult outside of the family system that is there for so many children and young people. And so they really have a window into exactly how this pandemic is playing out for families across the country. And I think it's very easy to ignore or underestimate the effect that has on educators themselves, actually. So overall, it's a time of great demand and difficulty for people. There are some positives within that. We've seen educators reporting that the sense of collegiality that they have with their colleagues on the school or college staff team is hugely vital to keeping them well and to helping them get through this. So those incredible relationships that we see in schools and colleges have really come into their own at this point. And senior leaders have done a pretty good job. You know, staff do feel appreciated. They feel seen, they feel supported in more numbers than we might typically see. So I think those are some real positives for us to focus on. And of course, standing right back, we know that in terms of public trust, educators are always in the top professions that the general public most trusts. And I think, you know, we've seen schools up and down the land really doing a huge amount for their local communities, being trusted. And that's not just about the transfer of knowledge to the brains of young people. You know, that's been about the most basic fundamental welfare issues that have become so significant and acute during these months.
So many directions we could take from there, Sinead. When you spoke about the three areas that education support work in, do you see, so the individual, the school and policy, do you see that they're equally weighted?
I think it probably, I think we could come up with different answers depending on the particular lens we were looking at this through. My argument would be that actually in policy terms, if we really genuinely want to improve the mental health and well-being of the workforce, and brackets, why would we do that? Well, I think we do it because if we have a healthier workforce, we're going to see better learning outcomes for children and young people. But I think we cannot do it without looking at each of those three levels, actually, because the well-being of anyone depends on how those things interact. As an individual, I can make my own decisions that are better and worse for my well-being. And I don't need anyone to judge me or regulate that. Thanks very much. But I, you know, it is good for me to learn to reflect on that and to be sure that I'm choiceful in what I'm doing, and I'm not kind of burying my head in the sand and not paying attention to the impact of the choices I make. But my individual choices do matter. You could then take a look at the workplace, and you can put me with my good and bad choices in any number of workplaces. And there'll be workplaces in which I thrive and my well-being is really quite well supported. And there'll be workplaces where I will really struggle because perhaps I have, you know, one of the most common reasons people struggle, they have very difficult relationships with their line manager. But it can also be because they work in an environment that is very focused on maybe targets and stuff that doesn't fit with how I like to work. And I have I feel a clash. I sense that actually I'm not able to put my attention to the whole child outcomes that I'd like to focus on, because over here I'm being driven to concentrate on these very specific outcomes. So I think workplace clearly has a big impact. And we know from the wider body of well-being literature that job satisfaction plays a very big role in the overall life satisfaction of any given person. So I think, you know, that's clearly important. But every school and college in the land sits inside the policy framework set by, in England, the Department for Education. And that has an impact. You know, school leaders might want to create a very particular environment, but they are constrained around what they can do in terms of what is required legally from them, and the advice and guidance and instruction that comes from the department is really key to shaping what they can do. And so we see actually across the piece some drivers that I would argue contribute to poor mental health and poor well-being that individual schools can't address. And actually I, as an individual person, can't change, you know, that's just the shape of it. So the extent, you know, are they weighted? Well, you know, if I've got a line management relationship that doesn't work, then the level of workplace is the most important because it's creating a lot of dissonance in my life. And if I'm someone who has difficulty with managing my alcohol intake or getting enough sleep, or taking physical exercise, then some of my personal choices may be the things that are most pressing on me. If I'm in a decent school, you know, with compassionate, open leadership, and I'm reasonably good at managing myself, and I'm still experiencing anxiety because of an Ofsted judgment or outcome or how that's made me feel about my profession, or thinking, well, hang on, why does nobody stand up and say, do you know what, teachers have put their lives on the line for the last 12 months, and here I am turning up and my own family has somebody vulnerable, and I don't feel that's been acknowledged. Well, that's a systemic outcome. So I think all of these things interact and probably are really equally valid, but we could make the argument for one over the other if we had a particular topic in mind, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I think they each come to the surface at different times. And I think many people have been experiencing phenomenal levels of uncertainty, especially SLT, that are having to make very big, important decisions with little information or changing information. And I think so that the wider, the kind of highest level of that umbrella has been incredibly difficult, especially for SLT, and the trickle-down effect of that. In terms of the work that you do at that level then, at policy or with the Department for Education, what are the key things that you're focusing on? What are you, you know, what do you feel passionate about? What would you like to see change at that level?
I know I need to limit this answer and not go on for 7 days. I think there are some things that would make a really big difference to the well-being of the whole workforce, actually, because it sets the culture for how we operate in schools and how we feel about ourselves. And I think the three things for me that I would be banging on the door most loudly about, the first one is accountability. And I'm a big fan of accountability. I'm a parent of young children. I think it's really important that we know that what's happening in the school is good stuff, you know. But I think that the way accountability works is unnecessarily producing a lot of tension and anxiety. And the impact of what happens inside schools when they're given a less than favorable Ofsted rating is not helpful. It's not positive, and it's not creating good learning environments for anyone. And I think that, you know, we are misunderstanding human relationships if we think that you can have a workforce operating under real stress and anxiety and a sense of, impending doom or failure. And imagine that wouldn't affect the kids in a class.
Exactly.
You know, I just think that there is a cognitive gap there if we think those two things happen on parallel tracks. Mm. And the fact is that this, you know, we know there are limitations to the accountability system in terms of the extent to which actually what's being judged is the socioeconomic demographic in a particular school, and that being the kind of net effect of how it works. This isn't healthy or positive for the communities that most need the best education. So I think how accountability works needs to change, and probably change fairly significantly. And that doesn't mean there's no accountability. I think it's a question of how it gets done. Mm-hmm. The second point for me would be around trust. And this is something we're only at the beginning of really understanding, but we're beginning to collate some data that tells us that, you know, overall the profession doesn't feel trusted by government. And that individually that then trickles down into people feeling that they are not professionally trusted in the classroom, either kind of locally in their school environment or actually more broadly, the way that education is structured gives a loud message that the education professional isn't trusted and must be very heavily directed by guidance and told how to teach and what to teach, and you know, the whole level of detail that really takes away the professional agency. So I think that sense of feeling trusted is really important. And we've seen, you know, some policy interventions, some government interventions over the last few months that really ramp up that sense of government doesn't trust educators. The Secretary of State's decision to threaten legal action before Christmas for the schools that wanted to close in London. Whether it's that or whether it's, you know, passing a law to say that schools are obliged to make sure that children and young people have access to online learning. None of this is speaking of a sense of regard or actually a sense of reflecting on what we know, which is that by and large, and of course, I'm sure there were some, you know, this can't be 100%. Nothing is ever 100% excellent. I'm sure the DfE would be the first to acknowledge. But the very vast majority of schools across the country and teachers up and down the land have been knocking themselves out. And it seems a real own goal to not acknowledge that and actually to play the counter argument. So I think trust is something that we will see becoming increasingly important over the next decade. And I think the third one for me is overwork. Yep. Overwork has become completely normalized in the education sector. You know, the idea that you could do your job as a teacher in kind of 35 or 40 hours a week is laughable.
Yeah.
Nobody even imagines that's doable. And, you know, we can talk about summer holidays, but increasingly holidays are eroded by preparation. And, you know, I think there is a question around what we're setting ourselves up for. And if we do look at the research around how stress and overwork operate, then it's blindingly obvious that we are industrializing the burnout of our educators. And again, you know, it's a very short-term perspective. What we want are fresh, energetic people coming into the classrooms, being present to children and young people, having the bounce to be able to engage with what those children and young people are presenting. And now more than ever, you know, we're looking to schools to act as a shock absorber on the impact of this pandemic. So we don't want bedraggled and exhausted educators, you know, crawling into the classroom and doing their best. But the structural, you know, it is a structural issue that means that the job can't be done in a reasonable amount of time. That's where the problem lies. I think you cannot say that 20,000 schools are bad workplaces. You know, yeah. This is a system issue.
I couldn't agree more. And I think coming back to your first point about accountability, I've worked in hundreds of schools over 15 years. And the number one thing that I see, I work with SLT, I've done all kinds of training in schools. The number one fear in schools is the dreaded call, you know, Ofsted are coming. And especially now, Sinead, when it's almost like a threat, oh, we're coming back, oh, we're going to look over your shoulder, you know, it doesn't feel like a partner. And I fully agree with you as well. We're not saying for a moment that we shouldn't have accountability, but it's the level of accountability, it's the type of accountability. And how can we build that as a supporting partner in this? You know, it's difficult enough as it is. And as you say, 20,000 schools cannot be wrong. So what do we do? What do we, to build trust, to explore the issue of overwork really sensibly and address it rather than, you know, the big stick, oh, we might have to all work through summer. Really? You know, I know these are big, huge questions and that we could talk about them for 7 days, but I guess my question here is, where do we say no? Where's the line? Where do, especially head teachers and senior leadership teams, but as individuals as well, where do we say enough is enough? The core business of school is to educate our young people to the best of our ability to prepare them for life. How do we square that circle?
I mean, I think this is such a pertinent question, and I've talked to a lot of people over these months, and you know, I can say with my privileged position of not working in a school, you know, well, we need to think about boundaries and we need to say, well, you know, the amount of work required is simply, you know, it's not achievable for many And size of school matters here, you know, but smaller schools in particular seem to be punished for being small and expected to operate in the same way that a trust academy chain can operate at scale. And so if you are a smaller school, it's almost certainly the case that you can't do all of the things being asked of you. And so one of the things I think is to decide what to put down rather than accidentally dropping something that you didn't mean to. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, means having to decide not to do things that you're supposed to do because you're meant to do it all. And that, I think, has to be done in conversation between the school leadership and the governors or the board. But it's a really difficult thing to countenance. And, you know, we've just seen months and months of school leaders spending their weekends and their evenings contact tracing for COVID cases, you know, which is a pretty long way away from a teaching and learning focus. So I think that, you know, the personal actions we can take are to just work out for ourselves where our boundaries are. How much time are we going to work and how are we going to use that time to get the best outcomes in terms of what we're trying to do for the children and young people? At the level of workplace, I think it's about, and we've seen actually great examples of people stripping everything back to the real core of teaching and learning, and that is what we do, and everything else is noise. And at some point, somebody will shout for something that hasn't been done, I'm sure, but there's, you know, been leaders who've taken decisions to say that's what we're doing because we can't do all the other things we're being asked to do. But I think there is a system level piece here, which is, you know, again, goes back to policymaking. And I think, you know, we can look at other countries. We don't have to go far. You can look at Wales, where they're putting well-being at the center of the, how education is going to operate from 2022. It's a core pillar of curriculum, but also, you know, relating also to the profession, because there is an understanding of the literature and of the fact that, you know, the well-being of the workforce is going to have a material difference on the outcomes for children and young people. I think until we get to a point in England where we are talking about well-being as a serious dimension of policy, we probably have work to do, because I think that's where we need to get to. Not because it's fluffy and not because we want everybody doing yoga and having fruit bowls in the staff room, lovely mm-hmm. as that might be, yeah. but because if we are not supporting any workforce to be at its best, we're missing a trick. And just at the moment where, you know, the vast majority of corporate organizations are prioritizing staff well-being, mm-hmm. making sure that they are supportive employers because they understand that their employees will do a better day's work if they feel strong and healthy and well. At just that same moment in the public service, we're seeing people kind of being lashed and no real regard for what happens to individuals when they operate under significant stress. And the fact is, it costs the system. You know, absenteeism and presenteeism cost us just shy of $2 billion a year. We could do a lot with $2 billion in education, you know. So this stuff matters, and it's serious.
And one of the statistics from the Teacher Wellbeing Index 2020 was 59% of senior leaderships have considered leaving the profession in the last 12 months. That kind of speaks volumes to what you've just described, Sinead. When we're looking at the policy level, the school level, and then to the individual level, what are you seeing? You described in one of the core pillars of what education support does, and that's the counselling service. One of the frightening statistics there is the number of, I'll just read it. In the period of April 1st, 2019 to the 31st of March, 2020, education support's free helpline handled 595 cases clinically assessed as being at risk of suicide. This is a 6% increase on the previous year. We're not talking about yoga and fruit balls here. We're talking about people's lives, and it's not a fluffy subject. When are we going to take this seriously? How are we going to start to look at these, the risk of suicide, the number of 59% of people looking to leave the profession? We have got to start to take this very seriously.
I think there are a lot of flashing red lights, you know, on the dashboard right now, and the proportion of senior leaders who are contemplating leaving education is one of them, you know, and plenty of them are close enough to retirement that they can execute that choice. You know, they're not going to be forced to stay for economic reasons. They can probably make it work to leave. And I think, you know, alongside that, we see an increased, I think it's the NAHT reported on this, a significantly reduced appetite among middle leaders to step into senior leadership because they're seeing what it does to their colleagues. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's not an advert. You can't kind of come up with a glossy brochure and say, look, school leadership, it's fantastic, get into it. When, you know, you've worked cheek by jowl with senior leaders and seeing them putting in 80-hour weeks for a year and still not feel like they're being listened to or consulted or have a role other than executing plans that they feel are often incorrect.
Yes.
And I think that just isn't a terribly appealing, you know, I speak as the leader of an organization. I wouldn't want to work in an environment where I couldn't have quite a strong degree of influence on what we're doing, because that's the upside of being a leader. Goodness knows there's plenty of downside. Yes. With the things that you carry. So, you know, you've got to find the upside and make that work. So I think, you know, that is a very serious factor that we do need to take seriously. And as for the extent of suicide risk, I mean, I think there's a whole lot more research that we need to do. We don't fully understand what goes into that. We know that the Office for National Statistics produced some numbers relating to 2017 data that suggested that early years and primary school teachers are 42% more likely to be at risk of suicide than the general population, which is big disparity. There's a question in there about what that's about and what leads to what and kind of causality and so on and so forth, that I think we need to, with great care and diligence, try and understand more about, particularly if the next set of ONS stats suggest that that wasn't, you know, a blip, but a sustained set of circumstances. And I think, you know, I tend to not talk too much about those statistics because I don't want to catastrophize and I don't want to terrify people. No. But I think, as you say, the fact is that there is plenty to give us cause for concern there. What we are going to see, and we are seeing all sorts of mental health issues at society level as a result of the pandemic. The Mental Health Foundation does regular population tracking, and it's a dismal picture. So I think more than ever, we need to understand what's going on and what the drivers are that put people in a situation where things become so difficult and so overwhelming for them. And we need more broadly, I think, in society in these coming couple of years to increase our collective awareness about what signs of concern are and how to talk to people. And how to become comfortable in having conversations when you feel someone's maybe not doing okay.
Mm-hmm. And it brings me back kind of to the beginning of our conversation where you talked about the three levels, the policy level, the school level, and the individual level. And I'm doing a piece of research at the moment now about what support really works for teachers and school leaders. And a common and slightly perplexing theme is, weaving back into the theme around workload, is they just simply don't have time to prioritize their own well-being, to do simple things like taking a 10-minute walk at any point during the day or eating lunch. You know, really key things that we need to do to take care of ourselves, because they feel they simply don't have the time. But the flip side of that is, when they do, and I have training and I teach them little simple things that they can do, when they do them, it helps. They describe it as being a life raft in a stormy sea. So how do we help, you know, people listening to this podcast? How, you know, my plea to listen is, please, please, put these small self-care steps in place. Sinead, do you have any thoughts or comments around that?
I'm smiling somewhat wryly because I had a fairly full-on autumn. And as we came to the end of it, I realised I'd fallen into all sorts of bad habits that I had done well previously with. So when my kids are here and I'm homeschooling, I'm a great role model. You know, we get up and out in the morning and we have a walk and we sit down and have some lunch and try and keep the atmosphere quite positive. Mm-hmm. But making sure that we have points of connection during the day, which of course means I get out and have a walk and I'm not skipping lunch. And that's very positive. But in the autumn, my kids were back in school. And so it all went out the window. I wasn't leaving the house for days on end. I was skipping meals. I was working late into the night and then not sleeping well because my head was full of work, right? Exactly. At, 10 o'clock, if you're still working, you're not going to fall asleep at 11 o'clock. No. It doesn't happen. No. So I feel very intimately connected with why we make some bad decisions. And I teach others this stuff, so I really should know better. But I think it's very easy in a set of circumstances like this to feel the imperative to literally do everything you possibly can do for those that you're there to support.
Okay.
And it's very hard to draw a line and say, okay, I can give this much, and then I've given everything I've got to give, and I'm going to retain an amount to prioritize my own well-being. And actually, I think the only way to make and kind of let it really settle in for yourself is if you can look in the mirror and realize, if I don't prioritize my own well-being, if I don't take these little moments of time to care for myself, I'm going to be a less good version of myself in a month's time and a significantly less good version of myself in 3 months' time. And I've come back after Christmas thinking, I'm not going to let myself get exhausted. I am going to boundary myself. I'm going to make sure I get decent sleep. I'm going to try and get out. I am going to get out every day, and so on and so forth. And in doing that, I won't end this term on my knees. I'll still be standing and still able to do the things that we need to do. So I think recognizing the fact that not doing the things that you're advising, Maria, will have a negative effect on your performance and will mean you do a less good job might help those of us who feel very attached to wanting to give everything, And another kind of salutary insight for me, somebody shared with me that when Bill Clinton was the president of the US, he used to take an hour every day, and he would go to the White House Library and sit and read for an hour every day. And that was his, what he chose to do for himself, for his well-being, for his, cognitive, whatever, that was his choice of activity. But I kind of have to keep coming back to myself and thinking, geez, if Bill Clinton can take an hour a day to read, I should be able to manage a walk. That should not be beyond my capability. As important as I am, I'm not the one sitting here with the nuclear codes. So I think if we can try and get a bit of perspective on the fact that we're not superheroes and Gotham City doesn't rest on our own individual set of shoulders, and that actually we will do better jobs if we take a little bit of care of ourselves, then I think test it out and see the evidence and ask those around you to comment. And the people around us are usually very good at telling us, well, actually, no, you're a bit tired and snippy. or no, you seemed much jollier after you had a walk, whatever it is.
Yes, yes, exactly. And the significance of this on the core business of schools is not to be underestimated as well. When we're well, as teachers and educators, when we're doing well, the impact on our pupils' learning and mental health is improved as well. There's ample evidence to show that. So please, our plea to you, dear listeners, is please just take the time, whatever that is in your daily activities, to find a way to take care of yourselves, and everything is just a little bit better when you do. Sinead, is there anything else? It feels like we've come full circle, but is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up?
I think the only thing to say is to anyone listening, thank you for all that you do. I sit here, working alongside the sector. I'm a school governor, I'm a parent, and I am humbled by what our educators do. And I thank you for the difference that you're making to families up and down the country. And just to remind people, if you ever want to have a chat, if you're just not having a great day, and you don't have to be in crisis for this, but our counselling team knows how to have a conversation, how to help you reflect on the thing that might be just bothering you or niggling in the back of your head. So that number is 08000 562 561, and is there 24/7.
That's wonderful. And I'll put that number in the show notes. So if you're driving or you can't make a note of it, it's in the show notes wherever you're listening to this podcast. Sinead, thank you so much for your time and wisdom this morning. It's been wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you, Maria. Thanks a million.
I've been speaking with Sinead McBurdy. You can connect with Sinead on Twitter at McBurdy Sinead. Again, that's in the show notes. And again, feel free to contact the Education Support Confidential Helpline on 0800 562 561, and their website is in the show notes as well. Thank you so much, Sinead.
Thanks a million.
Thanks so much for listening. Now check out our website, pursuitwellbeing.com. If you enjoyed the podcast, please hit the subscribe button in your podcast app. And if you feel inspired, please rate and review it and share it with your friends. I love getting your feedback and learning how we can improve our programme.